This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights, down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. G'day, Tobias. How are you?
Good morning. Yeah, good.
Yeah. It's chilly outside, but it's warm and toasty in the studio.
It is.
Before we kick off with some headlines, we've got a couple of things to spruik. Tell us about the T-shirt.
Oh, yeah. So we got only a couple of weeks left on the Solidarity Breakfast fundraiser T-shirt. Now, we have hit our target.
Yeah, thank you very much, everybody.
So thanks, everyone. Thanks, all our listeners. Thanks, people like Paul that I met at the protests. Absolute legend. We love all of you and appreciate all of your support.
Oh, and cheerio to Jason, who rings up every Saturday to tell
absolutely.
Us, have a good show.
Yeah, it's people like all of you that keep this station going and keep us coming in at 6 a.m., 6:30 a.m. or whenever. But the shirts, if you want one, I mean, they're limited time only.
And they're a limited run.
They're a limited run, and we're only going to print as many as they are. So if you can, you can call the desk and order one, get one reserved, pick it up, or get one shipped to your house through the website. But in a couple of weeks, they'll be shut, and then that's it. They'll be done.
Okay. All right. So there you go. And the limited run of Solidarity Breakfast T-shirts.
And then we also have some quick little giveaways Saturday morning.
We do have. No, it's not for Saturday morning. It's actually you can plan. It's for Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. There's some passes, double passes to two films. One is on Tuesday, the 29th of July. That's Tuesday coming up, and it's at 9:10 p.m. at the Nova, and it's called Union. It's directed by Brett Story and Stephen Mang, and it follows the modern labour organising union grassroots efforts of Amazon workers at the JFK 8 warehouse in Staten Island. If you are any way aware of union organising, you will be aware of the amazing work that these characters employed in order to work against what is probably the evil empire, Amazon.
It is. When we were driving around with Panos, who was on Stick Together and came on Solly Brecky as well, we were driving out in the country in just a massive
data
Amazon
centers.
Warehouse. It looks like the den of evil.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you want to find out about the nitty-gritty of that hard slog to get a union at that Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, you can get a double pass to go and see it if you give us a call after the show on 94198377. As I said, it's on Tuesday, the 29th of July, and it's at 9:10 p.m. at the Nova. And there's also on Thursday, the 31st of July at 8:50 p.m. at the Nova is a film called The Invisible Doctrine. And it's by Pete D. Hutchinson. In its investigative journalist George Mobiot unpacks the hidden origins, strategies, spread and global influence of neoliberalism, an ideology that has quietly reshaped economies, politics and public perceptions for decades. So if you want a double pass for that film or either of the films, give us a call after the show on 94198377 and you can get a comp and your name will be at the door.
Wouldn't that be exciting?
Yeah, it's always good to get something free. What do you reckon?
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
You're with Annie and Tobiah on Solidarity Breakfast here on a Saturday morning on 3CR, and you may be listening later on a podcast, so g'day.
We've got g'day, future people.
Yeah, future people. Chevron, you might have noticed that we in Australia spend a lot of time giving away a whole lot of things to international companies. Quite obviously, there must be a lot of shareholders in this country because all of us don't get anything for it, and neither does the country. Just recently, Chevron is going to be, and the federal and the Western Australian government will give Chevron $500 million in public money to clean up a contamination disaster caused by its oil and gas project on Barron Island off the coast of Western Australia. It was reported in a long article at Michael West Media by Peter Milne. The Western Australian federal governments are to pay more than $500 million for the cleanup of Chevron's Barron Island oil fields, returning about half the royalties they received over six decades. In May, Chevron stopped producing oil on Barron Island off the Western Australian coast, and the clock on a 40-year-old agreement started ticking. It will likely require the federal and Western Australian governments to help pay for the decommissioning and clean-up of a Western Australian nature reserve. After drilling about 900 wells over six decades, it will cost Chevron more than $2.3 billion to clean up the offshore nature reserve, according to a Western Australian government minute obtained by a boiling cold Freedom of Information request. During that time, Chevron produced 335 million barrels of oil and paid more than $1 billion in royalties, or about $3 per barrel. In the coming years, about half of those royalties will flow back to Chevron and its partners to offset their cleanup costs, diminishing the total value Australia got from the extraction of its resources.
How crazy is that? And they've built an absolute twisting spire in the centre of the city that overlooks like the Eye of Sauron on the entire western coast.
Yeah, it's really, really quite outrageous. Will we go on with the
The reports from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Sustainable Rivers Order and Basin Plan evaluation confirms what communities, scientists and First Nations have warned for years, that actually basin ecosystems are in decline. And I mean, when you pump that much water out without any control, I mean, as soon as I started doing radio, there was that book published, Captured, that has an incredible what's the editor's name, Philip Toner, but there's an incredible article, an essay in that book, Captured, that shows how much uncontrolled extraction of water in the Murray-Darling Basin happened and how it's led to these basin ecosystems in being in massive decline.
Without bold action to recover more water and let it flow, the rivers that sustain life across southeastern Australia face collapse, warned the Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance on Thursday. When we put water into wetlands, we know it works. We see fish breeding, birds nesting and life returning. But right now, those rivers are losing resilience. Without a radical shift in political will and investment, the next audit might read like an obituary, said Murray-Darling Conservation Alliance National Director
Craig Wilkins. And these are all almond farms and cotton farms. This is what is on the Murray-Darling that is extracting that much water. So have a think about it when you're having your almond latte in the morning. Is that really worth it?
Yeah, that's about right. There's actually a story that's closer to home, and I'll just see if I can find it amongst my...
I mean, interestingly enough, while you just find that story, I would and while we're encouraging people to do a general boycott, it should be of no surprise to everyone that they should absolutely immediately unsubscribe, boycott, and destroy in whatever digital space they can their Spotify account.
Ah, yes.
Because that the CEO, Daniel Elk, has now joined the board of that drone's, I think it's, I don't know if it's Danish or it's, I'm not sure, some
Finnish
company, yeah? The drone manufacturer. He's actually joined the board of the company that he was getting weapons or investing in weapons for. So essentially, he's exploiting...
Not only is a warmonger, but he's a destroyer of musicians'
I was watching money. A harrowing interview with a musician saying, yeah, look, we just sort of surrendered to the fact that streaming had won the music delivery battle. But then this was too egregious, and there is bands like Shushu, Deerhoof that are like in big indie bands that are pulling their entire catalogs because they do not want to be associated with automated murder drones.
This is the story that's a bit closer to home. The Gippsland Mines and Water. Ecological vandalism. Mining companies in Gippsland must pay their fair share for water to rehabilitate mine sites. Environment Victoria has told local communities in have joined local communities in calling on Minister for Water Gail Tierney to charge mining companies a fair price for the vast volumes of water they seek to take from the Latrobe River system and to reinvest that revenue into restoring the rivers they've damaged. With the Victorian Government's public consultation on pricing water for mine rehabilitation closing, that was on... tomorrow, that was midweek, Environment Victoria and local fishing and wildlife experts have warned that giving mining companies free access to vast quantities of water will have dire environmental consequences, unfairly preferences mining companies over the rest of the community. Gippsland rivers and lakes have already paid a high price for a century of coal. This is a chance for the government to turn things around by making polluters pay and using the money to heal our waterways, said Hayley Sitos, Senior Latrobe Valley Organiser for Environment Victoria. So it's everywhere.
It is. These massive corporations absolutely destroying and pillaging the land and paying absolute pittances for the damages that they've created over the decades.
And that's not even before we get onto the nuclear waste debacle that is now the door's been opened with AUKUS. Everything about AUKUS nuclear waste is a political secret, including the cost, which will more than double the $368 billion. It's such a big amount. Announced AUKUS price tag, says Rex Patrick, coming from the Michael West bulletin. If we ever get these subs, the total price tag may well be over $1 trillion. There's a whole range of problems with the waste and that Australia's nuclear-powered submarines will produce small amounts of low-level waste every year. Disposable gloves, wipes, reactor coolant and personal protective equipments. ASA Senate estimates briefly obtained under FOI suggested that this will amount to roughly the volume of a small skip bin each year. This, along with low-level waste from US and UK submarines operating out of Perth, will be stored at HMAS Stirling until the Australian Waste Management Agency builds and commissions the National Radioactive Waste Management Facility. It's such a great name, isn't it? Really what they're doing is opening the door for us, to Australia, to take the nuclear waste from all these warmongers all around the world.
Yeah, and I mean, it's all good. They'll put it in the Lara or the Wallert incinerator, probably.
Yeah.
You know?
That's, yeah, that's
probably
exactly
where
right.
They'll ship it off.
You've got some information about the two Israeli fellows who have been picked up. Are they fellows? They could be women.
Well, so they're two Israeli citizens, really, and that's all that really matters, but that they showed up to one of these electronic dance music festivals in Tomorrowland in Belgium and were reported by human rights activist groups, one being the Hind Rajab Foundation, which has gone on to track Israeli soldiers, their movements through their social media, and try and bring them to justice in an internationally coordinated legal action network with the Global Legal Action Network.
Are these the two that are related to the death of the little girl in the
car? They're not. The foundation takes the name from the little girl that was murdered in her car, but that foundation is just doing the work of identifying soldiers, tracking them based on their movements on social media and trying to bring them to justice in whatever country that they find themselves in. But they were reported because they were allegedly waving flags from their squadrons. So not that they were waving Israeli flags, which when I was speaking about it on the Philef program on Wednesday night, I was incorrect in saying it was simply an Israeli flag. It was actually battalion flags, allegedly, that they were waving. And so the police took them in, questioned them, but later released them. But it sets a minuscule in comparison precedent, but still it is a precedent that's happening where these people are being slowly, at the very least, brought to be questioned by the authorities.
This is at the same time as Oxfam is reporting that deadly diseases are now ripping through Gaza, even as millions of dollars of humanitarian aid piles up in warehouses across the region. Waterborne diseases that are both preventable and readily treatable and increased by almost 150% inside Gaza over the past 3 months as Israel continues to deliberately block aid. Repeat that. Israel continues to deliberately block aid. We're now going to go to the report that was contributed to us by Vivian Langford from the Climate Action Show. We know that this is in the context of the convergence to Canberra to bring the voice of the people to the parliament, which in its first week of sitting, it was the convergence brought thousands of people to Parliament House in Canberra calling for sanctions against Israel. But of course, the mainstream media failed to report. They require a please explain note. This is Senator Faruqi.
Last week, Green Senator Marine Faruqi held up a sign in the Senate saying, "Gaza is starving. Words won't feed them. Sanction Israel now." When she was disciplined, she said, "Instead of sanctioning me, maybe you should think about sanctioning Israel."
Now I'd like to introduce Senator Maureen Faruqi. Maureen has been a staunch supporter of the Palestinian cause for the past 20 months. She's the deputy leader of the Australian Greens, the only political party who has stood in solidarity with our cause. Please give a warm welcome to Maureen.
Sovereign owners of the lands we gathered on, the Gadigal people, and pay my respects to elders past and present. This is and always will be Aboriginal land. First Nations people in this country still bear the worst brunt of colonialism and its violence, and that must end. Imperialism and colonialism's violence and oppression around the world must also end. That's what we're here for today. You know, a few months ago, I used to say that we are sliding into a dystopian future. But we are already living in it today. Right now, are staring down the barrel of a potential World War III. The signs are all around us. The signs have been all around us. Israel has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, massacred them mercilessly. It has bombed five of its neighbors, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and now Iran. Israel is the only country in the Middle East with nuclear weapons. And yet, it faces no consequences, no red lines, no sanctions, no accountability. Israel can kill anyone it wants with full immunity from the rest of the world. We know that Israel is a rogue state, a state that operates, actually is allowed to operate outside of international law, a state that is rewarded, not punished, for its violence, showered with weapons, with trade deals, and with diplomatic cover from countries like Australia, the US, and the UK. And the hypocrisy of these countries is staggering. When Russia breaks international law, our government rightly condemns it and sanctions it. But when Israel launches illegal airstrikes and bombs on Iran, when it escalates a regional conflict, we get silence. We get evasion. We get excuses. Apparently, Israel has the right to bomb anyone, anywhere it wants. And now the U.S., led by that fascist Donald Trump, has bombed Iran as well. And what complete bastardry to call for peace after dropping the bombs. The Greens wholeheartedly condemn these attacks. They will be catastrophic for the people of Iran. It is the people that will suffer the most. And it is a clear breach. It is illegal. It is a clear breach of international law. But where is the voice of our government? Where is the voice of Foreign Minister Penny Wong? Where is the voice of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese? Nowhere. Labour speaks with strength when it comes to Russia, but falls completely silent when it is Israel or the US. Surely, if there was any moment, this is the moment to stop being the lackey and the cheerleader of the US. Show some independence and leadership. Show some independence and leadership. Hold warmongers and war criminals to account. That is what this government needs to do. And while all this is going on, how can we forget the mass devastation, displacement, demolition, slaughter, and starvation in Gaza? Brutal inhumanity and savagery. Israel has sealed off Gaza's borders, choking off life-saving aid. The only assistance being distributed comes through Israeli and US-backed channels, controlled by mercenaries who decide who lives and who dies in these death traps. That is what is happening there. This is not aid. This is domination. This is occupation. This is murder. This is erasure. The world has to see it as what it is. Hundreds of Palestinians have been shot dead by Israeli forces while trying to reach food and water. Thousands more have been injured, and millions are starving. Millions are being starved. All this happening while Western governments like our own, shamefully turn their backs and refuse to sanction Israel. You know what this looks like? This looks like moral cowardice to the extreme. And Palestinians are paying the price of this moral cowardice. Let's remember, this is not just a crisis for the people of Gaza and nations that are being bombed by Israel and the US. This is a crisis of conscience for all of us. This is a test of whether we will allow power, privilege, and colonialism to outweigh basic human rights and justice. The world is watching. The world could have stopped the genocide on Gaza, but it watched on. The world can stop Israel and the US beating the drums of war, but they are watching on. The world has been down this path before. I remember, we all remember, we have not forgotten the coalition of the willing and their war on Iraq based on complete lies about weapons of mass destruction. Shame! And now history is repeating itself with Israel's lies about Iran's nuclear capabilities, despite the US's own security assessment denying it. History, we know, history is riddled with colossal and unmitigated failures of the West's imperialist wars, which have been disasters for everyone. These imperialist wars have been disasters for everyone but the war industrial complex and those who profit from war. Australia must unequivocally condemn their war and refuse to join them in any way, shape, or form. And that means no using Pine Gap or any other military bases in this country. And that means an end to AUKUS right now. History will be the judge of those who stayed silent, who stayed complicit, and those who did nothing. But we will never be silent. We will keep demanding sanctions. Sanction Israel, not a few individuals. We demand accountability. Stop the genocide in Gaza. End the aid blockade. And stop the war on Iran and the Middle East. There is no excuse. There is no excuse. There is no justification. No justification for what we are witnessing. And we will not be complicit through silence. We will and we should only get louder and louder and more defiant than ever before. Because we are on the right side of history. And we will not stop until our government wakes up from their moral stupor. Because that is the least we can do. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. Palestine will be free, inshallah. Thank you so much, everyone, for your courage.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
And you're back with Annie and Tobias on Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station. And we're going to move to the picket at 33 Alfred Street, North Melbourne, or rather the issue of the Victorian government hell-bent on pulling down all the public housing towers. I went down on, and so did you.
Yeah, we did a cute little Solidarity Breakfast trade-off.
Yeah, yeah. On Monday morning, there was rumours that there were going to be some work being done. So I collected some information around what's the groups of people who are working towards picketing and stopping work being done on that particular tower and keeping an eye on other towers as well. By the end of the week, there was an action against a drill that was taking samples at 120 Racecourse Road. These samples are being used for the companies that are going to make tenders for the demolition of the towers. We start off hearing from Gabrielle De Vitry, who's the Green MLC for Richmond. And we end with her too, because she was there on the Friday. First up, we're at 33 Alfred Street in North Melbourne.
Last week we got a heads up from some of the residents here that workers had been coming in during the week last week, but residents managed to successfully turn them away themselves over a couple of days. But they felt like they weren't, you know, they kept coming back, and residents had to keep trying to, you know, confront them on a daily basis. So they wrote to us, and they wrote to the Minister and the Premier, saying that, you know, their rights to live here peacefully, that their tenancy rights had been breached, and that they had also breached their promise that they wouldn't come back to start interior works that lead to the demolition until residents were actually out. And you'll see in the foyer here, just taking a photo of it if anyone wants to see, there's a written promise from Homes Victoria saying, we will not start the dismantling of this building until residents have moved out. Now, what they consider to be the dismantling of the building might be, you know, literally taking the building apart. But if you're doing drilling work, if you're removing carpets and toilets and drilling into the wall to kind of work out how to dismantle the building, that is part of the demolition.
It is.
And when the residents got the works notice about this work, it said it was in the service of the demolition. So this is the point where we actually need to step in to stop it from happening. And it's a clear signal to the government that we will step in at every step of the way to stop them from proceeding with their plan to demolish the buildings, and particularly to do it while residents are still living here and haven't had the opportunity of moving into an appropriate location, or want to continue to stay here and resist the relocation. So we had a very explicit request to escalate our response to Homes Victoria and to return to the site to stop demo workers from continuing to do the work that they were doing, and specifically in the form of the pickets to resume. They also wanted some media focus on it and some advocacy internally with the government. So,
can I ask you, you've obviously are around what the government thinks it wants to do, which places they want to demolish and their timeline. Can you give my listeners a little bit of an understanding of that?
Yes. So their first sites are set on North Melbourne and Flemington, as well as the Carlton buildings that are already emptied, that were emptied a little while ago after a sewage leak. They want to get residents out by the 30th of September. This is an arbitrary deadline. They've given residents till then, and they want to start demolishing by October in North Melbourne and Flemington. The next tranche involves a tower in North Richmond, a tower in South Yarra, and 13 walk-up buildings in North Richmond, just adjacent to the estate. The plan after that is very unclear. They have sent a letter to every single public housing resident in these towers saying, we will be demolishing your home, but we don't know when. And we know that the timeline overall is quite extended over the next 28 years, but they're very keen to get on with this project, and they're very keen to be, you know, demolishing and privatising the land for the benefit of private property developers, essentially.
There's so many towers. I've been riding around and I keep coming across another tower, and I keep thinking to myself, these people are very vulnerable.
Yes, and there are so many people living in these buildings. 7,000 homes, more than 10,000 people living here. 10,000 people that the government is going to be shuffling around from building to building over the next 28 years while we have 150,000 people hunting for a public home.
And not only that, each of these properties are in places that private developers must be wetting themselves over.
Absolutely. Fitzroy, Collingwood, the Williamstown one is right on the river. They're really, really great locations, and public housing residents deserve to live there just as much as anyone else. But obviously the value of this land is really, really increasing. And they look at this land and they see, you know, the government sees dollar signs, and we look at this land and we see communities.
What we have is commitment from Homes Victoria that they will give us notice before they start serving notices to vacate and so forth. But the appeal of the legal proceedings won't happen until later in the year. So, you know, for these works to be commencing despite that happening, it's problematic. And
I'll tell you something interesting. We got a call from one of the staffers at the minister's office at 3CR, you know, objecting to something that was on one of the programs, saying that we're not starting work while people are in the buildings. It's factually incorrect. However, it's not factually incorrect.
Well, it might be external and it might only be investigative, but it's disruptive to people's lives. You know, if you've got a cherry picker here and you're drilling...
So it's splitting hairs.
Exactly, yeah. If you've got a cherry picker here and you're drilling into the side of the building, you know, it's adding to that feeling of anxiety that people have of, you know, wondering where they're going to go, feeling under pressure to leave. It could be that the legal proceedings are successful and they don't have to go anywhere, and yet this is a whole environment where they're feeling forced out.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's, you know, the difference between what ordinary people consider to be a reality and what the minister obviously considers to be a reality and what the government thinks is a reality are two different things.
Yeah, I mean, they've really engaged in a process of obfuscating the reality of things right from the word go, including the type of housing that's going to be rebuilt here, where people stand in terms of their legal rights, all of that stuff.
And the other one that's interesting is this sort of using the housing crisis, which is a reality, saying that really all this social housing is dealing with the problem of the housing crisis. But it's proving to be incorrect.
It's only going to add severely to the waitlist for the priority waitlist for public housing, social housing, and it goes contrary to previous renewal programs where they actually successfully infilled certain estates and retrofitted the buildings already there, allowed the communities to remain intact, and created more housing. There's other ways of doing it.
Yeah, so what really we're saying is that they're subscribing to an idea that their motives are one thing, but their motives are actually clearly they're giving the estates over to private developers.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, if they had have actually shown the public the costings of alternatives and the costings of what they're actually doing, showed us, you know, some kind of, like, documents that justify the need for the buildings to come down. They could maybe wage an argument otherwise, but in the absence
of all
that...
They're good intentions.
Yeah. In the absence of all that, it seems quite clear that our suspicions are correct, really.
My guess would be that they're parking the machine there to then fence it off to come back and use it at another time, that the machine's just being dropped off right now.
You've been part of the pickets around Alfred Street for a while. It's a watching brief, isn't it, to see what the workers are being sent to do and make sure that they don't get a chance to continue?
That's what we'd hope. The workers, someone else, another comrade has spoken to the workers and they have said that they're here to do some concrete testing, which would be demolition in my eyes, part of the demolition works. We'll see if they get tools out for that though.
Okay. So you guys are holding the CFMEU flags. I know you're CFMEU members. Are you hoping that it might actually have a positive effect on this picket and the workers?
I think we're really hoping that if there are any CFMEU members hired for this demolition job, that they see that there is actually an opposition from other members, that, like, as members of the community and members of the CFMEU, we should be supporting those who are in more need of public housing, and that this is actually hurting our community. And maybe at least it will give them pause to think about whether or not they should be on this job and whether they should be a part of this demolition. Like, losing public housing makes it difficult for all of us. Like, I just moved house, and the amount of people looking at the most disgusting, decrepit rentals in the private market is unreal. Like, there'll be 30 people all bidding for the same place, and we're all competing with one another when, you know, we could be putting the most vulnerable in public housing and letting the private market be less competitive for the rest of us, you know. So it has a trickle-down effect where it affects all of us who rely on housing, who rely on renting and support from the government. It's it makes everything more difficult, and it's already difficult enough. Yeah, it's absolute madness. And I mean, for me, it's really clear that it's not really about the people who live here. It's not about working class people in the surrounding suburbs or any suburb of Melbourne. It's about making profit for their property developer mates. It's absolutely decrepit. The house that I'm living in is falling apart. That house really needs to be demolished. But then, you know, like, low-income people are expected to live in conditions like that where, you know, like, you have unsafe living conditions with mould and damp and dodgy electrics, dodgy gas fittings, and we're just expected to put up with it and live in those conditions. So when I look at these public housing towers,
which they said, substandard, blah, blah, blah.
Compared to the private rental market, they're not substandard. Not at all.
So we're here at 120 Racecourse in Flemington, where drilling works have been continuing to do soil samples to make sure that to know what's underground to be able to basically demolish these buildings and build private homes on top. We've had one brave community member that has locked themselves onto the drilling equipment and stopped work. Give us a wave over there. And we've got a line of people from the community and residents who have who are basically picketing and blocking the entrance to the work site, effectively stopping work. This is the community's response within, you know, an hour of a community call out happening. We've got residents who have come down here who have confirmed that they want these works to stop. They don't want to lose their home, they don't want to lose their community, and we're going to, you know, be fighting this every single step of the way. We're fighting it in Parliament, we're fighting it in the courts, and we're fighting it here on the ground. Join us if you want to get involved and stop the demolition and privatisation of public housing here in Victoria.
And you're with Annie and Tobias on Solidarity Breakfast. And on the line, we've got Claire Hansen. She is from Save Public Housing. G'day, Claire. How are you?
Good, thanks, Annie. And it's Save Private Housing. Sorry, Save Public Housing Collective.
Collective, yes. Yeah, sorry.
Yep. It's okay.
Yep. No, it's good to underline that, actually, because that's exactly what's going on. It is a collective effort against this Victorian Labor government, its determination to demolish and privatise public housing.
Exactly. It's monstrous.
It's monstrous. So tell us, we've just been following the pickets that have been developing around the towers down in North Melbourne and along the drill sample drills down at Racecourse Road. There are other things that are being done, isn't it? And a rally is going to be called.
Yeah, we have a rally planned for next Saturday, the 2nd of August, and we're all meeting up at the State Library at 11 a.m. next Saturday, 11 a.m. and then we are marching to Homes Victoria in Lonsdale Street and then onto the steps of Parliament House. And we are hoping it is so big it stops traffic and there will be some speakers at each of our stopping points along the way.
Fantastic. Now, this is really important. It's been going on for a very long time, and I know, because I've been covering it for, it feels like a decade now. That,
it is nearly.
Yeah. And it's been bipartisan. It's not just the Labor government. It's actually all brands except for the Greens have been, and perhaps maybe some of the minor groups have been championing the public's need for public housing for a long time. Can you give my listeners some understanding of how your collective sees this issue?
Well, we clearly see the issue as dangerous because it is going to create more disaster for people who are in need, not less. The government, as you said, both of the major parties, use words like social housing, which we refuse to use because it means nothing. It's just a fluffy word that makes people feel good. Oh, they're looking after the needy. Social means nothing. It is handed over to and owned by and managed by community housing providers, and they are private companies. Do not be fooled by the word community. They are private companies. And they can cherry pick their tenant. The rent is higher. The buildings are appalling. I heard your previous caller talking about how bad her private house is. This new build that at Walker Street in Northcote, North Melbourne, Abbotsford Street, and Dunlop Avenue on the Ascotvale Estate have all been pulled down and replaced with these new builds that are so badly built. I do not know how they passed inspection. I'm deadly serious here. I don't know how. They're falling down already. They've only been open a couple of years and the maintenance on them is constant. Drainage issues, fittings falling on people's heads. You could put your fist through the wall without trying too hard. Mold everywhere. And these are only 2 years old.
And what was most bizarre when we were down at the 33 Alfred Street North Melbourne Towers, there were workers going up and doing general maintenance while they're planning to demolish them in what seems like a pretty, I would call it terrorism. The 28-year waiting to know whether your house is going to be pulled out from under you is insane.
I live in Walkups, and the Walkups were the original target, but particularly because nobody knows about Walkups. You can drive past an estate like where I live every day and not know we're here. Now, it just looks like a bunch of flats.
It looks like flats, really.
Exactly. So exactly, right? But everyone knows the towers. So the original plan was the public housing renewal scheme, the plan in 2017, I think. And the idea of that was to pull down all the walk-ups. No one would notice. I don't think the government expected the pushback that they got. I really don't. So they've got a new tactic now, and that is just give people 6 months' notice to evacuate so they don't have time to organise.
But you've been organising against that, and like I mean, you were saying successful campaigns, but even the picket was remarkably well attended by, like we heard from the recording that Annie did, there were CFMEU members down there ready to stop any people from doing this horrible work.
Yeah, except the CFMEU have a bad rep, unfortunately, and they're deregulated in Victoria, unfortunately, again. But by and large, they are on our side. When John Setka was in charge, we'd speak to the union and it was all jobs for the boys. They've got to be pulled down, jobs for the boys. There are jobs for the boys, I'm doing air quotes, in renovating the existing public housing, which is made of double brick, has sprung floorboards, balconies, plenty of natural light and cross ventilation. Plenty of work for the boys, bringing these up to 2025 standards. And there's a group of architects called Office who have already handed the federal government and the state government the feasibility studies on how these places can be brought up to today's standards for one quarter of the cost of demolition. That's in cash terms. Forget about the environmental footprint. You know, that's immeasurable, right, by pulling down these buildings. But a quarter of the price.
So what you're really pointing out is it's not about the money, is it? It's about something else.
It's absolutely about something else. It's backroom deals. We know that. The government, and I think we need to remind everybody that the government is us. They're not a separate entity. They're not this, you know, blob. They're us. They work for us. We pay them. These assets belong to us, not to the government, right? So they are selling off our property. You know, and they sold off our utilities, our public transport, which is not public transport. And they're just washing their hands of it and so they can go to the next election saying, look, we're back in the black because they sold off. You know, they've already paid John Holland $100 million to tear down Racecourse Road, Holland Court and Alfred Street in North Melbourne. They've already been paid.
And they're quite sneaky. Like, John Holland is not going to rock up. They're going to subcontract all the work out and make it really hard to identify. I was speaking to Sue Bolton there and some of the rank and file CFMEU members down there, and they were saying that they were bringing CFMEU flags to hopefully discourage people, but also that a lot of these workers that are coming on site are actually subcontractors and really hard to trace back to any form of unions or anything like that, or even, you know, taken from other communities from all the way on the other sides of Melbourne. So, you know.
Yes, I do. I'm well aware of that. They are very sneaky. As I said, Dan Andrews announced the demolition of the towers on television. These people who live in them heard it on television. That's appalling. Derek Beacon walk up with a view of ocean of the ocean.
Yeah, exactly.
They got 6 months.
They got
6 months notice, and the last ones, if you hang on and you've been offered, you know, they keep trying to offer you new places, if you keep resisting, you will eventually be given a straight-up eviction notice. No more public housing, community housing, no more help for you. You're out.
So we'll go back to the fact that there's going to be a rally on Saturday, the 2nd of August.
Yep.
That's next Saturday, 11 a.m. Everybody needs to meet at the State Library.
Yes, please come, people. This is very, very important. I mean, nobody ever thinks they will need public housing, but you may just fall into that trap, and it's a safety net. It is vital safety net for everyone. It is ours, not theirs. And we have noticed great public support when we do march, actually. People take photos of us and thumbs up us, but I don't want any more thumbs ups. I want boots on the ground.
Thanks very much for talking to us today, Claire.
Well, thank you. I'll talk anytime. Thank you.
A week solidarity, Bricky Team listener, when in the water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink department, congratulations to the Minister for Pollution, Murray Swats, the Environment, for providing $14 million to assist those affected by South Tribulawassee's disastrous algal bloom. Probably would have been smarter to have done something about it months ago, as the bloom was at its embryonic stage, when scientists pleaded with Murray to take action, and Murray, with understandably deep concern, explained it was none of his business, none of his blooming business. Getting in early to prevent an environmental disaster is none of the business of the minister. Let's give him his official title, Minister for the Environment. Then, Murray, what is your business? Oh, of course, approving gas until 2070 so we can transition from gas, and assuring us Woodside with profits will cause no damage whatever to 50,000 years of Indigenous art. And Murray also asserts the environmental disaster, the worst marine disaster we've known according to marine scientists, is not a national disaster, leaving us to ponder what level of damage of disaster might qualify. No worries here in Victoria either, as we saw ducks swimming in water that had turned blue. Who knows what exists below the surface? The big build constructing lane upon lane upon lane upon lane of exhaust pipe and plastic pollution of the Northeast Link, believed responsible, but good news. The government assured us the pollution poses no health threat whatever. It is totally safe, it guaranteed. Thank goodness. So what is the chemical? We don't know. The minister don't know. Phew, thank goodness. Totally safe, unknown chemical pollution. The scientists who pleaded unsuccessfully with Murray months ago suggest climate change, if there is such a thing, may have a bit to do with the algae, like roughly 100% give or take. And as the heavens flooded Texas, one of the big fossil polluters, a fossil, not that it's an orphan in that department, but taken by this headline in the Spencer Street, no longer Spencer Street, Fairfax the other day, Texans search heaven and earth for flood answers. We're not sure they need to look that far. Still, climate change, if there is such a thing, has its positives, like as the Arctic melts, the fossils have access to more fossils, more riches, like great fossil behemoth Conoco flips the blame, delighting US of the UN of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump of the poor, he of drill, baby, drill. Conoco flips the blame, applying to extend its oil drilling in Alaska the potential for hundreds of millions of barrels. It's so clever, isn't it? Climate change, if there is, caused by the great corporates like Conoco flips, thaws the poles and allows them to contribute even more to the transition from themselves. With the usual suspects like long-haired, greedy, commie, wooden working and iron environmentalists carrying on about the bit of pollution all this would cause, and Native Americans claiming it will damage their country. No concern whatever for what the Conoco flip shareholders want and need. Whatever happened to good old-fashioned take and take? Not that there's any problems. With Donald at the helm, the right decision will be made. On the important need for more fossils so we can transition from more fossils, the aforementioned Woodside with profits continues to take its responsibilities seriously. This week, our old mate Supremo Meg O'Neill before profits announcing proudly that with new global fossil acquisitions, Woodside with is achieving its ambition of being one of the world's great fossils, showing its unswerving dedication to the transition. Meg keeps reminding us all this fossils, gas is all about. Albeit obviously a slow process, as the permit to coexist with the 50,000 years of rock art until 2070 attests. And we know they can coexist because Murray and Western Tribulawassee Supremo Roger Cook the Planet told us they can coexist. Challenged by the local Terra Nullius non-land, non-people, this Save Our Songlines mob, who claim all that gas will destroy their sacred sites, based on nothing more than years of gas already causing irreparable damage. But if it comes to Murray and Roger and Meg, or these non-land, non-people, we know who to believe. As a by-the-by on these matters, the Political Maturity of the Week award must go to that appalling Hoonson and her no-notion lot for turning their backs on an acknowledgement of country as the Talkfest opened. Don't they know it's just token and won't lead to anything as damaging or dangerous as policy? After a mere 21 months of defending Zion's right to defend itself against an occupied people, who by inference, under that definition, have no right to oppose being occupied and terrorised, no right to defend themselves, our courageous government joined lots of other countries in suggesting maybe the defend itself was going a bit far. Don't slaughter, destruct, genocide, starve quite as much. And then thousands of people sign a petition suggesting words without action aren't enough. Ban contact, sanction the real terrorists, words and action. Would that stop us sending weapons parts to Zion, the minister for being offensive and trained killing Richard Moores, the bad guys, he of the giant mind, looked very concerned on behalf of the socialists. You mean the weapons you deny we send? Exactly. Can we still supply the weapons we deny we send? Well, no. Shame on you. Shame on you for supporting a blatantly anti-Semitic petition. Watching the footy Thursday night, Carlton being thrashed yet again, interspersed with those ads we get after every goal, that contributed to public-private health boo-poor dears informing us it is a proud sponsor of the Carlton Football Club, and I thought, how appropriate. The team getting its weekly thrashing, and good old boo-poor dears, perhaps that should be blue-poor dears, anyway, boo-poor, recently fined millions for taking the money but refusing to provide the service, and now being hit for cutting staff and making shift changes at its aged care facilities. The nurses' union claiming not only problems for workers but also a threat to the quality of service. So I thought, Carlton and boo-poor do make a fine team. On the great corporates, ANZ for Service Bank is being investigated by the Trublowazi Securities and Investments Commission over a little matter of alleged bond market manipulation. The investigation being dragged out because ANZ4 keeps complaining about interviews with members of its key markets team being too aggressive. Oh dear. Why can't the investigators just take no for an answer? They must know how sensitive good, respectable bankers are. And it came to light the tax department, so vigilant and relentless, waived a $1 million tax bill owed by former big supremo and the world's greatest worst ex-treasurer, Paul. A true socialist, as the revelation revealed a heap of corporates and cross-corporates owned by Paul. That's why, as a true socialist, he so empathises with the poorest of the poor, who are nonetheless facing a cornucopia of riches, as current big supremo Anthony Albanese said, although his salary is 600 plus grand, and after 30 years with his bum on the plush seats, I know I get a good salary, but I know what it's like to struggle. See? Empathy. And given in that moment of elation on election night he guaranteed no one will be left behind, then the poorest of the poor, like the unemployed, could expect the cornucopia to start flowing any time soon. Coal behemoth Adani bloody environmentalist has avoided the little problem of having a huge tax bill waived. Just don't pay any in the first place. See, despite its huge fossil mine, which did cause a bit of protest, and its subsidiary, Trains Carrying the Pollution to its Port, another subsidiary, they're all losing millions year after year. So much as it would just love to pay tax on all that pollution, it just can't. How come a profitable polluter is losing so much, I hear? Well, see, it owes millions each year, coincidentally roughly what the mine earns, to debtors in low-tax places, loans and interest and lease payments, debtors who, what do we know, just happen to be also subsidiaries of the Adani bloody conglomerate. But I hope no one would think for a second this might be a tax dodge. And Alcoa, the transnational aluminium power guzzler, with massive worldwide profits, Canadian business provides aluminium for the US of, or aluminium as they say. But profits have taken a dive thanks to Donald's tariffs. So what's the answer? The Canadian government, Alcoa says, must come to the rescue. See, governments do have a role to play in the laissez-faire, dog-eat-dog world of the greatest little economic order of them all. In the gee, who would have seen that coming department, our state socialists introduced a tax on empty homes, hoping to help solve the housing crisis. But figures show thousands of developers and investors are avoiding the tax because of one little problem the government obviously overlooked, like, how do you know? Anyway, the Property Profits Council said the tax prevents developers and investors solving the housing crisis, which is, of course, uppermost on their minds. Finally, notice Donald's latest medical examination shows he has a vein problem. Surely we didn't need a medical test to tell us that. Good morning.
As the Taco Helm apocalypse approaches us with impending doom, it's time for the best alternative comedy debate in NAM.
Join us for the 21st annual Green Left Comedy Debate, where progressive comedians will debate whether or not billionaires should run the government.
Featuring your famous, award-winning comedian Tom Ballard as our MC, with the brilliant talents of Nikki Barry, Hellchild, Shirley Hood, Rose Callahan, Sarah Bartolo, and David Fowles.
It will be happening at Saturday, August 9th at the Brunswick Town Hall, with dinner and doors open at 6:30 p.m. with the show beginning at 8 p.m.
There'll be food, drinks and laughter, and special guest President Donald Dump leading the positive team. Take it away, Don.
It's going to be a big debate, a great debate, a beautiful debate. I thought of it, by the way.
And all proceeds to the event will go towards activist media Green Left. So come along and join us on Saturday, August the 9th at the Brunswick Town Hall. And book your tickets by going onto the Green Left website or visiting greenleft.org/events. Green Left is a 3CR supporter.
You're back with Annie and Tobias on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got Don Sutherland on the line. G'day, Don. How are you? Sorry, it'd be good if I pressed the button. Sorry, mate.
Yeah.
Hello.
I'm well. Thank you, Annie.
Yeah, great. Well, it's been a bit of a while since we spoke to you, and you were sent off to do some work and research into the upcoming economic roundtable.
Yes, and I do wish to talk about that from a slightly different angle than last time. First thing I'd like to do, Annie, if I may, is send out solidarity greetings to the people of Cuba and all of my friends in Cuba who, of course, in our time, it's going to be about midnight tonight, begin their commemoration and celebration of their National Rebellion Day.
Oh, fantastic.
When they fought for and established fundamental principles of sovereignty, and in doing so had to defeat American imperialism, which has angrily responded to them with what is now, I think, about a decades-long economic blockade. And I was very happy earlier in the week to begin our next project to get some equipment into the Cuban Children's Hospital. That in effect defies the blockade. So, if I hope you that little indulgence is acceptable to everyone. That we and solidarity also to all of us Australians who actively work to support Cuba against U.S. imperialism's blockade against their people.
Yeah, exactly. Consciousness that that was actually going to happen. So I'm glad that you brought it up. It's interesting that Cuba has been actively defending itself against American imperialism while we actively prostrate ourselves in front of it.
Yeah. And I mean, if people want to go, there's also the, I was looking at it later in the year, they're sending out the Southern Cross Brigades are going to Cuba, and so you can go. And I presume you've been maybe a few times as well, Don.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and it sounds amazing from what everyone. Not that this is an ad spot for them, but I mean, it sounds like an incredible opportunity. Like, you work with and find out about Cuba and or to have all these experiences that aren't just, willy-nilly travelling or anything like that?
Yeah, well, it's one very good way of learning about how to stand up to American imperialism as a nation and the whole concept of sovereignty, how they define it and how it is deeply rooted in the day-to-day belief system of the people. But perhaps we can come back to that another time. I would like to develop our thinking about the economic reform roundtable.
I thought you were having a stroke.
It's an unfortunate acronym, as I said last time. I think the important thing about this, there's a number of angles. Firstly, if we had a government with strong socialist characteristics and wanted those to go further, we would do something similar, actually, because productivity is so important for a humanist approach to the development of society and for the rescue and replenishment of nature. And so conceptually, the fact that the government is doing it is a lot of common sense in it. But although, of course, they are not doing it for those reasons. But those reasons that I gave about what we would do, if you like, mean that we have to take it seriously and work out exactly what's going on. And in so doing, improve our economic literacy, deepen it, put that deep into the day-to-day thinking.
So, Don, what are they doing it for?
Well, they're doing it because there are indeed serious problems in capitalist societies, not just Australia's, but the capitalist societies around the world. Capitalism itself is not solving the problems that it creates.
No, but don't they want to go into dictatorship?
Well, some do, and some want to and see greater survivability in the continuity of a very restricted parliamentary democracy. And so there is a battle going on within that. But I think we can best begin to understand it by taking what is going to be talked about the most, that is productivity, back into our daily experience. And I'll just say, by, it's an economic reform roundtable in which productivity has been pushed to be the centrepiece.
Yeah, see, the whole thing about productivity, I mean, I was thinking as I was riding along here this morning about the fundamental inequality that's been created within our society, even down to the inability for a whole groups of people to be able to use the social fabric because of the change in technological approach. Everyone has to move along towards the belief structure and economic belief from these commercial outlets, you know, like the use of AI, for example, not intrinsically bad, but it's being used to roughhouse people into particular methodologies and excludes whole sections of the community from actually interacting.
Well, I think this is a really important angle. First thing is that economic reform, there's nothing at all happening in this conference about closing the gap.
Well, therefore, it's a complete waste of time.
Secondly, we go to the process itself. There are going to be, at this stage, there are 24 invitees. The government has invited 24 people. They are the elite, right? And most of them, in fact, all of them, although three or four, five perhaps, with less intensity, all believe in the dynamics that have created the problems and have been supporters of decision-making in the past that have made the problems worse. So 19 out of the 25 invitees definitely are contributors to the problem. And the problems are many. The most, in terms of daily life, there is no question that there is a connection between climate change and the algal bloom. So the productivity possibilities of food production in South Australia are now prescribed by the accumulated and flow-on effects of climate change. Secondly, part of the problem of the worsening productivity performance is that the first indicator, the populist mainstream indicator of wealth per person shows it declining. Wealth per person is already in recession. And that's reinforced by other measures of the same thing.
It's funny you should say this because I'm reading this book called Solenoid and it's set in Romania. And it's like everything in the Balkans is terrible. All dictatorships, all society, everything about it doesn't work for ordinary people. So is this what they're after? It doesn't work for ordinary people. It only works for the 19 or 24 people who are sitting around this table.
Well, there will be a minority of wage earners that end up with marginally better wages income.
Well, bully for them.
Into their superannuation and so on. But that's part of convincing us. See, what they're on about is getting a consensus, not just at the elite level, but starting there, a consensus that flows down through the general population. Now, I'm not talking, they're going to get resistance as well, particularly from activists who actually pay attention to what they're doing. But the real problem will be the extent to which this whole process enables the working class majority to sort of be complacent and to give consent to, in a de facto way, to what anything new the government wants to do beyond what it committed to in the election. So this consent building process we have to have our head around as well, and that means we do have to get on top of the facts as well, like there is currently declining standards of living. The statistics on that the mainstream media report are clear in themselves, but it's actually far worse because they are skewed. So they say that they're really bad, but they're actually much worse because their approach includes all of those on millions of dollars of wealth and income every year.
So the statistical analysis is ridiculous.
Yeah. So working all of this out is very important. What is the opportunity? You see, they're so clever. Well, it's more than clever. It's also sensible and so on. In setting up a process of extending the consensus building in three ways. Firstly, through the event itself and how it's reported in the mainstream media. And that would include...
We get the idea. What about two?
Number two is where the Productivity Commission, a major instrument of protecting the system that causes the problem, has engaged in a consultation exercise, an open consultation exercise, that invited people, anyone, using their website, to put in ideas to solve the problem, particularly the productivity problem. And they're worth having a look at because some of them, you know, they'd make sense to the likes of you and I.
Mm-hmm.
So they're worth having a look at the PC website. Now, secondly, then you have, for example, the Australian Council of Trade Unions did...
Yeah, they did their survey and it came out with people telling us that they're overworked and they've got no confidence in anything.
Yeah, so that was a good thing to do conceptually. It's very hard to see the details.
Well, it's qualitative. It's not quantitative, and therefore the powers that be don't see it as being new science.
But it takes us, the principal public discussion the ACTU generated, takes us to that workers ought to be led by managers who pay attention to them. But let me tell you a little story. About 40 years ago, I was seconded to the Labor Council in South Australia to be the technology education officer, where my task was to develop and run training programs, union education, for workers grappling with new forms of technology and technology management at that time. And so, you know, great education. There, lucky me, I get to sit down with 15 to 20 workers every couple of weeks for 3 days or 2 days to learn about their experience of this. In the process, I visited the place that makes wine casks, fills the casks with wine,
yep,
and so on. Cut a long story short, walking around the shop floor, and the biggest problem in that production process was how to make sure that when the silver bladder filled with wine drops into the cask, the tap lines up with the perforation holes in the box.
Yep.
You know that problem? Probably.
Yeah, yeah, go on. What happened?
And the rate was at the time about 6 out of 10 dropped so that the tap aligned to the perforation box. A worker picked up a bit of wire on the floor, fashioned it into a particular shape, wound it onto the end of the chute where the bladder dropped from, and it jumped from about 6 out of 10 to on average 8 or 9 out of 10, falling into the right place. About 3 weeks later, she was made redundant. So there's productivity improvement controlled by the employer. Where consensus says the workers should volunteer what they know about how to make production more efficient, in this system, the first option is to lay off the worker.
Yeah, that's right. And it's funny, you know, because my experience of running a business or creating a business over at the top of another one was resistant workers who taught me a very valuable lesson. The reason I had to work out why it was that they were sitting on their hands, and it was because of their supreme cynicism about the employer and their relationship with that employer.
So I guess the point I'm trying to make about this, reinforced by your example as well, is that this is a very narrow way. What the ACTU is focused on is probably more in their material than what has been made public so far. So I'll qualify it there. But that particular, selecting that to be the public focus, has got a serious problem with it from a worker's point of view. And I do hope that the ACTU has got a deeper set of proposals than that. We see, for example, that the AMWU National Secretary has put the shorter working week as a general entitlement out there. A shorter working week with no loss of pay. And so he should, and that's good. Last time we talked, I said that ought to be an element of what could be a concept of socially useful productivity employment. So that's the sort of thing that I hope comes through. But the real question is, how do we make this, all of this stuff, more relevant to and improve, if you like to use terrible jargon, the economic literacy of working people so that they become the primary agents in making the changes that are necessary as time goes by. Now,
well, we have to wrap up shortly, so come up with make sure that you get your chance.
I'll finish with this to explain the problem. The problem is fundamentally the system, and it has to be changed through socialist momentum of some form. Good example. Every night, Alan Cole is on the ABC, and he gives often a very handy little pithy summary of what's going on in the economy. Recently, he repeated the new jargon, capital deepening. Capital deepening is the new jargon that is intended to make everything benign. The idea behind the simple concept is that there is much more investment in physical assets relative to the labour employed or the wages paid. The ratio of fixed assets to wages increases. The problem with that is that it requires much, much more fixed asset investment that Australian capitalism has been willing to deliver. But the more you deliver, in the very first instance, profits fall.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they've got a long history. They've got a long history of not actually investing.
And fixing that requires an increase in the rate of exploitation.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, we have to leave it there. So you don't hold out much hope for this round table.
I think it's very dangerous, but I think it's a great opportunity for us to build a more unified alternative.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Well, it's a watching brief, and we'll find out more about it as it develops. Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, Don.
Lovely to do so. Best wishes to everybody.
And that was Don Sutherland, and we are right at the end of the program. But we just remind you that if you're interested in a double pass to go and see Union, which is on Tuesday, the 29th of July, 9:10 p.m. at the Nova, it tells you about the union organising for Amazon workers at the JFK 8 warehouse in Staten Island. You can give us a call, or on Thursday, the 31st of July, there's a couple of double passes to The Invisible Doctrine. Investigative journalist George Mobius unpacks the hidden origin, strategy, spread and global influence of neoliberalism. Both films are at the Nova, and they're both part of the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. The phone number is
94198377. Asia Pacific Currents is up next. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
And we're going to go out with Double Dare Ya, Bikini Kill.
Is that supposed to be doing that? Okay, we're starting now. We're Bikini Kill, and we want revolution! Girls don't know!
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.